You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
I was 17. I got my first tattoo, which is the Dodge logo from 1973, which is my, I have a 73 Charger. So that's like, that's Mopar. That's me, you know. Then like 4 weeks later, we were having another tattoo party. And because I was hosting it, it was my house. The guy was like, hey, you get free work again. And I was like, I don't know what I want. Like, I just got like the best tattoo ever, that, you know. And my girlfriend at the time was wearing a shirt from this local band called Pennywise, not the punk band, some other local band with the same name. And the shirt was a sun that was like, had a face in it, was like snarling. And this is like 5:30, 6:30 in the morning. We'd been partying since probably 9 the night before. And my buddy goes, that would be really cool, but if it was your face. And I was like, yeah. So I just went.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of 2020. I'm Siobhan Cronin, here as always with my compatriots, my cohorts, Benny Goodman and Corey Peza. How's it going, guys?
It's going great.
Well.
Benny is oddly demure, as he always is during our intros, because don't worry, he's going to blow up the microphone later. But back again, part two. Go back and listen to part one if you haven't yet. Jason Lechberg, we continue our conversation, talk more about his band, some of his other experiences in the industry.
Yeah, you can learn what a producer does, because we don't know.
A lot of people don't know, as we've learned.
Jason is very, very much an anomaly because he's so hyper intelligent and he uses very, very highbrow ways to explain everything from cryptocurrency to how a producer interacts with a band, especially with a singer that doesn't know what they're doing. But beyond that, also how marketing can be employed to really build your brand and hammer it home.
You're using your NPR voice for this one.
It's kind of like the difference in Jason's voice in his band, because he goes from, like, you know, how I normally talk to this. And it's very, it's strange, yeah, but also different.
But you're lulling people into a false sense of security, because that is not how this episode is going to sound shortly after you hear this intro that's going to happen in a couple seconds on 2020 with Jason Lechberg. Hello and welcome to another episode of 2020. My name is Corey Peza. I'm here as always with my co-hosts, Siobhan Cronin.
Hey.
And Benny Goodman.
Hello there, sir.
Hello. And we're back for our second hour for the second time with our good friend Jason Lechberg of Lechberg Enterprises. What? Were you throwing deuces?
There's two twos.
It's 2020.
Deuce and deuce.
2020 in your intro. You've lost all momentum.
Nobody heard our guest name.
If people aren't subscribed already, you should. But if you want to change the channel,
as long as you're screaming in your mic.
I kind of want to change the channel at this point. The channel. aside from being a marketing guru with Lechberg Enterprises and managing all sorts of great bands, or the product managing, I should say, all sorts of great bands, like you got Steel Panther, Gwar, Lost Symphony, the greatest band of all time. You're also in a pretty badass band called Nefariant, which I believe is going to actually be doing some live performances relatively soon.
Scary, but yeah, it's happening. June 12th and August 21st so far, both outdoor shows. But yeah, we're going to take a run at it. So let's see.
What's that process been like to kind of navigate the world of live shows right now?
It's been tough. A lot of the venues here in New York, you know, because of where the regulations are, they're just not even reopening yet, because until we get to a certain capacity, it doesn't even matter, COVID safe or not, they can't sell enough tickets to make it to not lose money being open. Yeah. So they're having to stay closed. And a lot of the venues too, you know, we're still waiting to see what's going to happen with like rent and things like that, you know, whether they're going to end up having to pay the back rent for a year and a half. And if they do, that may be the end of a lot of venues, you know? So there's a lot of that is still unknown. So, you know, some of the bigger places that we would normally play, I'm, you know, called to talk to, and they're just like, we're not talking about this. We're not doing anything. We're not involved. And so, you know, a couple of promoters have started to like pick and choose things, and these outdoor stages are something they're starting to do, because they're like, okay, it feels like will be able to at least get that far. But everything's reduced capacity right now. I mean, I think the area we're playing is 300 cap, but currently we can only put 130 people.
But if you're vaccinated, can't you just like laugh at all the people that could like that are just going out and you know, putting themselves at risk and just be elitist about it and just be like, I can breathe in your space and I just have, you know, periodontics disease and that's all you're going to get from me.
Periodontics disease. It's horrible.
It smells. Have you ever been close to somebody like somebody who's like invading your space and you're just like, why are your gums rotting in my nose?
Yeah. It's
what does that have to do with
it's being one nose? She's probably had somebody at like a conductor or something that's like, you've missed the tritone. And you're just like, but you missed brushing your teeth from last week.
The pleasant like consequences of everyone wearing masks now, though. You don't have to deal
very
with
true.
That.
Well, they should
very
know
true.
That their breath smells.
And honestly thought that I would not mind keeping masks in place for shows for that very reason.
For sure. Well, how's to know that even if you're vaccinated, you can't continue to transmit? I mean, I think we'll probably still be finding out a lot of things down the road, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how live shows function.
Yeah. Definitely. So it's, you know, I mean, we're doing it because we want to try and we want to get out there and we want to play again. You know, I mean, honestly, we're not even going to make that much money, but it's about like, just getting out there and trying to make forward progress. Cause as a young band, I mean, we launched February 28th
yes.
of 2020.
Great timing.
Yeah. And right. and when the pandemic hit, we just kind of decided, hey, like, you know, nobody needs to be trying to hear from us in the middle of this year. So we just went away, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe you can tell us about, for the listeners that don't know, the formation of the band, you know, all, some of the members, how you guys came together.
Why should we care about you, Jason?
I mean, the short answer to that is I don't know that you should.
You are not good at marketing. Can we fire him? Like, that's the worst answer ever. What do you?
I don't know. I'm kind of intrigued now. It's like reverse psychology, right?
Is it?
You know what it is? It's honesty. And I'm going to give you
reasons. Well, that's even worse.
I'm going to give you reasons.
If you don't even believe in yourself, why the fuck would I believe in you?
Oh, I didn't say anything about me not believing in myself. I have my own face tattooed on my arm up to the shoulder. Like, I believe in myself more than just about anything.
I have my own profile picture, okay? Not just my face, but my actual avatar, but it's also on my own.
There you go. Well, you won't.
Wait, you actually have your face on
yeah,
your
arm? Yeah, that's actually my own face. Yeah.
Wait, what's the inspiration for that?
It's very bad. All right. So
how drunk were you?
When I was 17, I grew up in Indiana and I got my first tattoo. So we used to do these things called tattoo parties where you would find a tattoo artist and you would get them to come to your house and you would throw a party and everybody would come over. And because
you
were
your friend with needles that says they can draw things.
I'm still right, afraid to get my first one. This is fascinating. Go on.
Yeah. So basically what happens is they don't have to pay the shop fee. So they charge less and everybody gets together and has a good time. But that basically means everybody's fucked up all night. And this guy's fucked up and also tattooing. So I was 17. I got my first tattoo, which is the Dodge logo from 1973, which is I have a 73 Charger. So that's like, that's Mopar. That's me, you know? Then like 4 weeks later, we were having another tattoo party. And because I was hosting it, it was my house. The guy was like, hey, you get free work again. And I was like, I don't know what I want. Like, I just got like the best tattoo ever, that, you know? And my girlfriend at the time was wearing a shirt from this local band called Pennywise, not the punk band, some other local band with the same name. And the shirt was a sun that was like, had a face in it. It was like snarling. And this is like 5:30, 6:30 in the morning. We'd been partying since probably 9 the night before. And my buddy goes, that would be really cool, but if it was your face. And I was like, yeah. So I just went for like an hour and this dude did a very bad job of tattooing.
So it was like life. He was like actually tattooing your face, like off of your face. Like, yeah, not just well, like a so, picture.
No.
So is that basically truly art imitating life?
Yeah. And then life imitating art again. So it was really, really, really bad. Very bad tattoo. But I can't ever get rid of it because if you ever meet somebody and they go, I don't know, Jason Lechberg, you can be like, well, he has his own face tattooed on his arm. And that just kind of like, that's enough. You got it.
So that's a great story.
I believe in myself yeah. to a frightening degree. But what I start off with by saying, I don't know that you should care about me because I don't know that you should. I'm going to give you reasons why I think that you should, but I don't know that you should. So I've been playing music for most of my life, and I was in a band that put out three albums and did some decent touring and was on Sirius and got all the metal blog coverage, and the public basically decided that they didn't care. You know, there were definitely people who liked it, but they didn't really care. Not enough for us to make it a career. And after the last formation of that band completely disintegrated because, you know, living on the road and making no money and busting your ass is tough. People just, you know, they wear out. I decided that it was time to completely start over. Instead of rebuilding the band, I just wanted to completely start over. And I had this idea to do something very melodically different, something that I didn't see happening in the industry at that time, which is kind of, my idea was a cross between Typo and Gojira and Insomnium and Evergrey, finding a way to put those things together. And I didn't hear that. There wasn't a couple of years ago, there wasn't a lot of stuff that was really heavy, but still really melodic, like really had strong, strong melody lines in it, and big hooks and stuff. I mean, and there, and I mean like really heavy, like, cause you know, there are bands that are like radio bands that are still heavy that have that stuff, but like a new young band that was doing something like that, yeah, with also kind of like a gothy and a darker feel to it. So that was the idea. And I just, I started putting together. The bass player from that last project came along with me, and we ended up getting the drummer who was the last drummer in that project. And then the bass player has since moved on. But, and then we took a couple of years putting together the project and the piano player. We have a piano player, not a keyboard player. Like, he straight up plays a piano. So like no synth sounds and all that stuff. He just plays piano.
Do you still use MIDI to fix him?
No, he's got to play that shit.
That sounds tiresome.
Yeah,
it is, but he's got to play that shit.
Yeah.
You know, so that made it a little different because he kind of sits in the place that a lead guitar would, but because he's got both of his hands, you know, he's walking all over the bass down here and he's walking all over the guitar up here and walking all over me everywhere. So, you know, it's definitely been tough to fit him in, but he was my intern back at Epic 13 years ago or something. And then he went on to have his own career. And
so is he like Ray Manzarek in the Doors, where like either like, we have this nice tight song called Light My Fire. He's like, hold on, bro. I could play the bass part with my feet, and then I could do a 7-minute solo on my Vox Supercontinental solo. And you can, and what you can do is you can walk around the stage, you can pass out, take some more acid, you can do whatever you want. And they're like, yes, let's empower our keyboardist to not only replace the bass player, but also be like the lead guitarist, because the guitarist in the Doors had only been playing for 3 months. And well, it sounds like it.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. He'd only been playing for 3 months?
Yeah, actually, the only song that made me at first instilled value for me was Spanish Caravan, because it has that little flamenco thing. You know, Robbie Krieger did a good job considering the fact that he just got thrown into it. But yeah, he'd basically been doing nothing, and he like hung out with Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek and Oliver Stone at UCLA. He was at the right place at the right time, and his stupid hippie poem, Light My Fire, became one of the biggest songs ever. And now he's actually become a good guitar player because if you hear him play, he plays the keyboard parts and stuff on the guitar now, because he's had 50 years to get better and he chose to. So I gave him that. But back in that day, it was lacking.
Never been a Doors fan. That may explain it.
There's a lot of things it's one of those things that when I was a child, it was like, he was mystical, but then you go watch it now on Palladia and you're like, wait a minute. Was I fooled into thinking that this was a thing?
We were all emotionally manipulated by the things that resonated with us when we first heard it. And that's the beauty and the evil of music.
Yes.
I remember thinking Ozzy was a really good singer.
Dude, me too.
And then you go back.
When was the moment that you realized that Ozzy, like, that Ozzy was actually never good, and it's just different levels of bad?
But here's the thing. What is good? Like, Is it because
on key, in time, like, just start there.
But why do those matter? No, but more along the lines of, like, because I think we've had this conversation before on another episode, but like, you know, when you first hear music and songs, and you're listening as an outsider, it's so weird going back to those things after you've been a musician and you've had to, you know, you're inside of music. It blows my mind listening to the things I listened to when I first knew how to turn the radio on and what I thought of them. And I actually wish, I mean, I'm sure that it could take acid, but a way to get back to that mindset, without drugs, to actually listen to music without all the analytical bullshit that courses through my brain would be phenomenal. Yeah.
You don't think that you shouldn't go to Shannon Larkin's lair?
That's actually
and take some tea and then listen on his with the turtles and the koi fish, and that you should maybe listen to some Franz Liszt, like I suggested. And that you can relearn to be excited about things once again. Because I think
excited,
I know what you're referring
to. About the things
the
I
disillusionment
got about.
Of learning that maybe those bands that you loved growing up weren't actually as good as you thought they were, because they made you feel better than now knowing as a musician than they actually are. Because now you're the guy going, David Copperfield does this. You know, you're behind the curtain. You're the Wizard of Oz. And you're like, I could do this better. But back then, I remember listening to Stone Temple Pilots back in the day and going, how did he sing so many times at once? How did they do this? I didn't even know what an overdub was.
No, I mean, I listened to music that was out of key and out of time, and it didn't bother me. It was like, I love this song.
Well, for me, a lot of it now is recording quality, because my ear was not as good to hearing good mixes, right? So I will go back now and listen. I'll be like, oh man, I can't wait to go back and listen to this recording I used to love. And then I listen, I'm like, damn.
There's a lot of records I can't listen to anymore.
Yeah. It's amazing. And that's why I'm stressed out all the time. Cause everything I listen to, everything I record, I'm just like, no, it's not good enough. I can't achieve the perfection that I hear in my ear. It's hard. Yeah. The more you train your ear, for sure.
The funny one for me is that I use the example of the Misfits a lot, because whenever I hear someone cover the Misfits, I'm like, what a great song. But then if I listen to the Misfits version, I'm like, meh.
You know, Dylan built an entire career off of that, because you're like, All on the Watchtower, what a good Jimi Hendrix song. You're like, no, that's Bob Dylan. And then you're like, Blowing in the Wind, Bette Midler was the greatest. Like, no, that's Bob Dylan. And you're like, Feel Your Love, that was Prince, Billy Joel, or Adele, depending on what decade you're in. Bob Dylan. But then you go and you're like, I'm blown in the wind. And you're like, what the fuck? It's like listening to Lou Reed, except if Lou Reed was worse. And Leonard Cohen was like, I'm going to come and make awesome music again.
Shows,
horrible.
It shows.
How is Hallelujah so good from Jeff Buckley? But then you hear Leonard Cohen, you're like,
it can be a good song with a bad performance or a different performance. But a good song is a good song. If someone else takes it.
Well, think about even now. There are performers and then they have songwriters. Some people that are the greatest performers of music aren't even necessarily writing those songs, and vice versa. You know? Yeah. So, I mean.
Which is a fascinating thing for me. And all of us on this screen are performers. So I don't know how I could really get into, I mean, I'm, you know, sometimes I've worked with other people and they've brought in other band members, I got this line and I've worked to make that part of my own. But if it just was walking in a room and had no emotional connection to a song, I don't know if I could perform it. Could you?
Welcome to my entire life.
If you're Steven Tyler and Joe Perry and you're hanging out, and Desmond Child walks in the room and goes, guys, I know you did Draw the Line, Sweet Emotion. I got our pivot. I got it. Dude looks like a lady. How do you not sing that and own it?
You know, I think this is an eternal struggle for musicians, because I've been on both sides of this, and I haven't recorded other people's music, but you know, there's a band who I love, a young rock band who I really, really love, who are on their way up. And on their last album, their producer wrote the significant amount of a song that the label fell in love with and said, this is our single. And their manager's a good friend of mine as well. And the manager called me and was like, I need you to listen to this. The band hates it. I don't know where I sit on it, you know? And I listened to the song and I was like, guys, that's a fucking smash. I was like, that is just a smash. There's nothing to say about it. And they didn't want to hear that. They were upset about it. They went through with it. They put the song out, probably the biggest song they've had in their career.
Wait, but we know how this story ends. Sinead O'Connor walks in. She goes, I've written 12 songs for my record. And they're like, but we have a 13th song. Prince wrote it for you. It's called Nothing Compares to You. I don't want that as a single. I did not write that song.
Yeah.
They're like, but no. Prince wrote it for you. And then they put her on camera, made her cry, made the dumbest B-roll of all time. And it's the only hit that she had. And she had to literally rip a Bible up live on Saturday Night Live, or a picture of the Pope, to let people know that she didn't like Prince representing the fact that she could actually write herself.
I mean, you know, again,
it's just a manic Monday.
It's the curse of being an artist, because you're going to do things that are as valuable to you or more valuable to you than anything else. And the public's not going to give a shit. And the thing that they may like is the thing that you like the least. And you got to make a choice. Like,
well, what if you're the Goo Goo Dolls and you think you're a punk band, and then you come out with a song called Name, and then your label says, why don't you write a bunch more names? Do you pull a Goo Goo Dolls and then you become an acoustic band that writes like lame elevator music and make gajillions of dollars? Or do you still like, you know, they're like Marcy's Playground. Like, I don't want to write about sex or candy anymore and then have no career.
I mean, look, I think Johnny Resnick was always going that way. Like when you read those, when you look at those
chin,
early,
I agree. Like, you just look right into like the middle of his chin and you know exactly that he was like, I'm going to write weird tuning acoustic songs.
How much smoke can you produce in one breath?
That was a lot. Yeah. But I think Johnny was always going that way. And I think that band was all. And frankly, I'm actually, here's a shocker for you. I am a big fan of those Goo Goo Dolls songs. All the acoustic, Black Balloon, all that stuff. I mean, those songs are just fantastic.
What if
songs.
I said that they were going on tour with Collective Soul? How much happier would you be?
Collective Soul was all right.
Because that's a band.
Collective Soul's like, funny to me because they were like, they wanted to be heavy almost. Like they have like heavy riffs, but like the most like
no gain.
No, yeah, it's just super heavy. If they just like punched it up, and the singing was a little
soft. Do you know how many records Collective Soul has actually sold? That's the thing that they're one of those ridiculous bands that like are deceptively humongous, where they've sold, they have like probably 20 like Billboard charting top 25 hits. Like no doubt, including probably, I don't know, at least 10 top 10 hits. Like it's insane. You're like, how?
Yeah.
It's called Adult Top 40 Radio, or AAA, depending on what market you're in. And it's not stuff that we listen to, but there are a whole lot of people with little fish stickers and like the five little stencil people on the back of their window that listen to it all day long.
I feel very disconnected from this demographic.
Life, man.
Meanwhile, I'm playing music by dead people and wondering why I'm still poor. So.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen. Did you not know that like Schubert died like sick of syphilis with papers all over his apartment, like destitute? I mean,
a lot of the composers died.
Would it make you happy to know that like by the time you were 7 years old, you'd written Fantasy for Four Hands, but then you still die of a venereal disease by yourself with a bunch of unpublished genius that nobody even cared about?
But I think that's art. I think that's exactly what art is.
Venereal diseases?
The inequity of what happens. I mean, you know, the one of the guys who runs Metal Sucks says this all the time. He says that, you know, the phenomenon of making a living from music has only really been around for like the last 70 years at this point, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to that, like nobody made a living making music unless you were somebody's, you know,
like a commission gig
commission,
or something.
Yeah, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, basically
know, right?
That's so, how the composers lived too, yeah. They had some rich people sponsoring them to write stuff and they were like, all right, and that's how a lot of that stuff
have
got
you
produced.
Guys ever seen the movie Amadeus? They used to have like battle offs where they'd get like Mozart in a room with like Beethoven and be like, here's your harpsichord versus the pianoforte. Go! And Gilbert Gottfried would like read all the stuff in between. And now
is that
for variation on Salieri?
I just lost a frequency in my ear.
Yeah. Sorry. Did that happen? Did that really happen? Or was that just for that movie? Was that like when...
I think they actually did stuff like that, but like they dramatized it more.
They
of like
dramatized
a UFC
it,
fight
I'm sure.
But yeah, no, they had rich elitist motherfuckers that would absolutely get Siobhan and people like her and be like, dance, bitch. You're going to represent Germany and you're going to represent Meyer Court fucking France. Go. And then they'd go. And she'd play her Stradivarius and they'd play their Amati and we'd see who'd win. And then whoever won, it would be like, here's a bunch of gold and whores and good food. And they would send them back.
Not much has changed. They just pay actual cash money now instead.
Yeah, I was about to say, have you guys seen Eurovision?
I've seen Euro Trip. I know that Scotty doesn't know.
Yeah. No, but what's the name? I'm sorry, Eurovision. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, it's the Eurovision Song Contest. That's what it's called. Every country submits a band or a singer or an artist in Europe, and they have like an American Idol style thing where they all perform and they get voted and they like battle it out. And they're still doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of in that vein, I feel like it's very, very difficult to be like a true, true artist and be successful, like especially now, like to come up in the industry. In your experience with bands, not only that you've worked with, but you've been around, like how do people generally lean? Like when they get that call from the label or the producer that's like, yeah, we're going to run this song because it's even though you don't like it, this is the one that's going to go. Are most bands that are actually making a living just like, okay, well, we can keep doing this if we do this versus we're going to lose money? Or is there a lot of pushback nowadays where making money is so difficult in music?
I mean, I think one of the things that I learned, I don't know, it's been quite a few years now, but one of the things that really changed the way that I approach almost everybody I deal with in the music industry is that when I truly understood that every artist in the music industry has worked as hard as I have and as every artist you've ever met has, and every one of them believes as much in their art as we do. And that includes the people who make music that we go, oh yeah, okay, whatever. Like, you know what I mean? Like a perfect example, I watched, I think Vice is doing this series. It's like the story of...
I'm going to tell you, song. Hardwell did not work hard or well, and he's very far. He's been called the best DJ in the world, and I watched that whole documentary where he spoke about himself in third person, and all it did is make me fucking hate my life and want to pull an Avicii on myself.
Yeah, that's...
That's a little bit of a different thing. I would say, like, you know, playing an instrument, learning an instrument, and then, like, going out and doing shows and building that, you know.
But he spoke about himself in third person as he was doing B-roll of himself playing piano. I actually play piano, and it was horrible. It literally was, like, unlistenable. At least Deadmau5 has the fucking courtesy to say that I don't even play instruments. I just have thousands of millions of dollars worth of keyboards I just look at.
I will never watch that documentary, I promise you.
Don't.
All right, but go on, Jason. So you were talking about something that you were watching?
Yeah, so the Vice does this thing called The Story Of, and they did like Cisco's The Thong Song. And I thought, you know, it's like a 7 or 8 minute thing on YouTube.
That's a
and
great I would, idea.
Yeah, and I was like, oh man, this is going to be horrible. Man, this dude sat there and talked about it like, this is how we built the hook, and this is where this part came in, and we took it from this.
That song is genius, dude.
Yeah, it's a very well-written pop song, but they took it as seriously as I took any song I've ever written in my life. And so I have yet to meet an actual artist, a signed artist that's actually out there working, that's not a hired gun. Because I'll say that, I've definitely met some hired guns who are like, what do you want me to look like? I'm doing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like the actual artists that are writing music and you know, steering the ship on their own career, I have never met one that didn't believe wholeheartedly in their music as much as every one of us does.
Yeah.
Well, I think especially with pop, like there's no question about it. Writing a hit song's hard. Like otherwise everyone would do it. So it's complete bullshit to be like, oh, they're a pop writer, I should say, artist, who knows whether or not they even have met the writer. But like, it's really hard. And you have people, you know, obviously like Max Martin, that's one of the most prolific songwriters of like the century. And no, you know, people know who he is, but most people don't. But he's talented as fuck. And so who's the new guy that's got all the hits now? Is it Lewis Bell? Does all the Post Malone and Bieber stuff? Like, it's incredible. Like,
and Ozzy Osbourne.
What?
The guy who does Post Malone also does all the Ozzy stuff. In fact, Post Malone and Ozzy have a bunch of songs together, and it even makes sense. Hmm. Like, that guy is a genius.
The last record, yeah. The guy who was producing the Post Malone record produced the last Ozzy record, yeah.
And the current Ozzy record that has 15 songs, who knows what that sounds like.
Yeah, no, but I encounter this a lot in the classical world, where especially like me as a crossover musician, it's like there is a lot of talk amongst classical people that's like, oh yeah, pop music is a sellout and this is easy. And it's like, I've come to respect it so much more even than I did, because I was stuck in that world of like the trained musician and people that were like, oh, the only real music was written by dead guys from 300 years ago. And it's like, it is so hard. And you really do have to have so much dedication and commitment to like what you believe in your style of music. You're so right about that.
Well, let me say something as someone who's DJed hundreds of weddings. When you see people from every walk of life throw their purses down and then go, ooh, that dress so scandalous, and you know another blank couldn't handle it, see you shaking that thing like, who's that ish? With the look in your eyes so devilish, you like to dance at this hip-hop spots and you cruise the cruise like connect the dots, not just some urban, she likes to pop, because she was living La Vida Loca, which was a huge song at the time. That's genius. But you listen to the pre-chorus. This isn't even the chorus. Listen to the hook in this. She had dumps like a truck, thighs like what? Baby, move your butt. I'll sing it again. And then he says the same thing again. If that's not operant conditioning and going, hey man, we're going to hammer this home literally like a dump truck. That's poetry. And I'm telling you, it takes a lot to know as a producer how much it takes to do that. Because I see a bunch of people out of nowhere, they'll sing that word for word. And that says something.
I didn't even know what song you were singing until you got to the pre-chorus.
That is the song. I have heard it so many times, it's 109 BPM, and it's perfect. It's perfect, perfect transition if you want to go up to 128 from like 100.
Perfect. DJ skills.
110-ish.
There you go. I don't know.
But anyways, how's Nefariant right?
Right.
We're still discovering that, yeah. You know, honestly. We write a lot. I would say the first couple of songs, it was either, you know, guitar based where we started, or it was piano, and we were trying to fit the two things together. But we've gotten to a place now, the last couple of songs where I'm very happy that we're writing things that are like, we're together now. You know, we understand how these instruments fit. And so we're writing things that are not a piano riff writing to a guitar riff, or not a guitar riff writing to a piano riff, but rather here's a melodic thought. Let's put these things together. So I'm excited about that. It's very, very collaborative. I can't play anything. I write stuff and try not to fall off stage. That's what I do. So, you know, when we get in a room together, it's usually like we're in a room. Here's some ideas. We have I covered one whole door with just like white vinyl, and we have this crazy calligraphy that we write, or like how we map out the songs and just go back and forth and work on them until we don't hate them, I guess.
It's a good strategy. You guys have you have a song out now and a video. It's Life on Fire.
Yeah.
And it's killer. I mean, if anyone hasn't checked it out yet, look it up. It's super cool video. Great song. And
what a lovely voice you have.
Thank you.
Like, seriously, like I feel like my mom when I say this, like, cause like you have like this anger that like would scare off like, you know, any evil demon that like when you put two mirrors and create a portal and things start moving around your house, like they'd go back with the way that you scream. But then all of a sudden it's like, and it's not like quite ghost. It's not there. It makes sense. It's like definitely not like disconcerting. But it's beautiful. And it is very melodic, but it's disconcerting for someone who's used to like, I guess, the abrasiveness. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, this almost feels good. Is that what we're supposed to feel? Am I supposed to feel good after listening to that music? Is that the objective?
I'm good with that. I'll take that. Thank you.
Because I felt good, but I was like, I don't feel like metal's meant to make me feel good, because like Maiden always makes me feel like I'm about to go to the gallows pole.
Yeah. I would say maybe, you know, which this is, I'm going to say something that no one ever does, but if you listened a little more to the lyrics, you probably would not feel as good.
I don't listen to lyrics at all.
I was going to say, I'm the same. Like I remember melody and lyrics. My brain does not compute.
That's where you're a man. John Garabedian called it out. Women listen to lyrics. Men listen to, but that's also because that's the musician inside of you. Whereas women are more sensual, thinking about, the inferred feeling, where men are like, but the solo goes din-in-in-in-in-in-in-in-in-in-in.
Yeah. The piano player in my band is a real estate agent, and a bunch of people in his office, obviously, they came to see us last February. They've seen the video, and apparently now they started every time they close a sale, they just yell out in the office, "My life's on fire." And they started saying that. And I was like, they have not listened to these lyrics. They have no idea what this song's about.
You mean like when they played Sweet Home Alabama for like politics in Alabama? And it's like, guys.
Yeah.
Not the right song.
No. Yeah. So, you know, I appreciate the compliment. Thank you very much. It definitely is meant to be a little bit dark, so probably not the best feeling, but that's all right.
Well, you have the kind of juxtaposition between the melodic aspect and the darker lyrics. I think it, you know, that adds depth, right?
That's what I'm going for, hopefully.
No, it's very cool. And you mentioned before with the piano, it's definitely a unique sound. And you had Ulrich Wilde, who's been on the show, mix it, correct?
Yes.
And, you know, there's a trap with metal bands to sound exactly like every other metal band because you want to be aggressive and have that like in your face. You want to compete with every other metal band out there. And I think you guys found a really good balance of having this, like, it's like a softness over this super brutal metal sound, which gives it something that I don't think I've heard recently.
I can tell you what it reminds me of. It's like, I forget what they call the effect, but like when they're in the movie Reservoir Dogs and they're playing the song Stuck in the Middle with You, but then they cut off the guy's ear. It gives you two cross emotions because it's like stuck in the middle and the guy's walking around like with the razor, like having a blast. And the guy's like, and they cut off his ear. But like, if you didn't know, he's just having a good time. He's having a great time, but he's cutting off the fucker's ear. That's how I feel with your music. I feel like, am I supposed to feel bad that the guy's getting his ear cut off, or should I be stuck in the middle with you? Like, I don't know. I don't know how that's supposed to make me feel. It's a very strange Venn diagram of emotions that I don't know which polar side I'm supposed to end at.
I absolutely love that. That is amazing. Thank you very much. That's fantastic. I mean, and to your point, Corey, our internal branding messaging is actually elegant and brutal. That's exactly what we're trying to do.
Nailed it!
Don't figure that you of all people would nail that.
Thank you. I love that. I would do that.
Benny, it's funny that you bring up that scene because I actually wrote a treatment for one of the other songs that is a takeoff of that scene specifically. Yeah, you got
as
it.
As always, very on brand. Yeah. No, that's amazing.
Yeah. So that's the idea. Exactly. We want to do two different things. And I think I had an idea in my head initially of what I wanted it to sound like and the lane that I felt like it fit in. And we had it mixed once with a guy who I love and who we track with, and he's amazing. And he listened to everything that I said. And because, as we'll find out at the end of this story, we didn't give him what he needed, the mix that came out was not right. And we knew it wasn't right.
He listened to everything the singer that doesn't play music said.
Yes.
I already know what the problem is.
Yeah.
You know what Ulrich Wilde said to us? He goes, "I don't listen to what anyone says about anything. I just get the tracks and start."
So, see, that's what I was about to say, because I sent Ulrich exactly the same instructions and exactly the same references. And he wrote me back 3 days later and just said, "I didn't listen to any of those things. I just mixed it the way that it needed to be mixed." And the first pass, I was like, "Oh, yeah, this is amazing. What this band is." And he actually helped us kind of like find ourselves, because, you know, there's two guys in this band who are from the Midwest. And we grew up playing in the Midwest. And when you know that and you hear Nefarent, you're like, "Oh yeah, that's Midwest." Like, there are some like Chicago things happening in this.
But you bring up a really good point that a lot of people don't acknowledge. It's one thing to play in a band room, in a basement, whatever, and hear your band. And it's another thing to put your band on in a car or at someone's house and for it to sound good, or how you think it sounds, because it's a totally different experience. And sometimes you have to go into a studio and get a guy like Ulrich Wilde to be like, no, dude, this is what it is. And then you recreate the sound that you've heard your band sounds like when it's like the final report card. You're like, this is my report. And they turn it in. And it's already been edited by the teacher with all the lines. You're like, wait a minute, that's not what I wrote. And then you listen to it and you're like, I have to play that. And you go back and you actually figure out how to make yourself sound like that. And then that's when at practice, you start sounding like the band that you actually were meant to be versus just a band in a room like every other fucking band.
100%. 100%. Yeah. And that's exactly what he did. We didn't want to be as Midwest as we are, but we couldn't deny it because it's who we are. And we,
what makes you Midwest? I'm curious because I, you know, growing up, I didn't really go to band concerts. I grew up in the Midwest.
So like,
okay.
we do call soda pop. So, you know, specifically the drummer's from Chicago and I'm from Indiana, and there's a very specific, when you think about the bands that are from Chicago, you think about Nonpoint, Disturbed.
I think about Chicago. You're my inspiration, Jason.
Yeah, it's a great band. Great band.
Don't blow your head off.
I will try not to.
Russian Roulette never ends in a good way.
No. But you know, when you think about the approach of those bands and how they approach drumming, if you hear those bands, you listen to what they're doing, it's like you just hear it. It's right there. Like big fans of Soulfly and like a very tribal rhythmic kind of like a lot of Pantera in there as well, even though they're obviously Texas, but like there's that influence hit the Midwest really hard in the 90s. And so when you came up in that area, hearing all those metal bands that we came up in and came up playing around, there's kind of a very specific approach.
Wait. Let's slow that down. You said Pantera influenced the Midwest, and then they influenced massively the fucking world in the 90s.
But
like, I mean, America in particular, but like I was in Boston, and Pantera was my fucking religion.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when they came around, like when everyone talks about being in the 80s and like they had nothing else. And when he saw bands, it was like, oh, my God, that's my hit parader come alive. That was the first band that I saw that I was like literally, I had butterflies more than anything in my world. So I'm not saying that they didn't influence the Midwest, but I want to make it clear that when they used to come to Boston, they sold out every single time. And that like that influenced an
Pantera
entire
was pretty
scene.
Big.
Yeah, they were a huge.
Period.
Yeah.
Period. Period.
I'm aware. They were big. What were you going to say, Siobhan?
No. I was just going to tell Ben to shut up.
So anyways, there's a very specific like approach that you hear. And my vocal is, especially my heavy vocal, and the cadence of what I do, and about half of what I do, is also very Midwest. There are a lot of bands, I think, that I've even tried to get away from it a little bit, but it's just who I am. There's nothing I can do about it. So,
are you able to go from that angry growl to the sing for the for real in the studio, or do you have to like have like the compression change to a different thing? And you're like Wayne Stack, who's like, you push it, because that's what he told me. He told me it's all compression for him, and I thought it sounded great. But like, could you actually do it at that volume, or are you like one of those guys that manipulates your head to make it sound like what we're hearing?
No, I mean, all of my screams are subglottal, which is the same. You know what that is. Yeah. So everything is coming from, as they would say it in like singer speak, everything is coming out of false chord as opposed to fry. I don't do hardly any fry at all. So even my high notes are affected false chord and my low notes are affected false chord. So I'm full volume. I am a very, very loud singer, like sometimes like not good loud, how loud I am. So it's very, my clean voice is actually still louder than my screams, but not significantly louder. So I don't think people
realize that for singers, and I got to say this as someone who attempts to sing, I'm not saying I'm a singer. I've attempted, but like volume, especially if you notice, I can't control the volume of my voice even when I speak. Nevertheless, when I sing, I can't even sing. And like, it's like it goes from like to like, and I have so much respect from like, you know, when you go listen to like Mariah Carey and like you're listening to like early Carey, like I'm talking like Tommy Mottola was totally nailing her and she was like trying to be a good girl like way before she got thugged out. Like you listen to her go from her like falsetto to her head voice to her chest voice, like literally like she's dancing around like Nancy Kerrigan before someone found a bat. Like it's fucking insane. And I have so much respect for that now as a vocalist because I can't do that. Mike Patton, that guy is like literally a magician with his vocal cords.
Unreal. That guy's unreal.
Yeah, some people are just built different. It's insane.
Yeah.
Devin Townsend.
He's amazing. Jesse from Killswitch.
Yeah, listen, Jesse and Howard, because there's the argument all day, the Venn diagram, and I'm so glad they did that, the song together that they did to finally shut the fuck up. Everybody was like, oh, well, I like Jesse, I like Howard, and they're like, we can like each other, man. Yeah. And they made a brutal song where they basically took the best of Howard and the best of Jesse. And it's not like Jesse being the current singer had to push down Howard. He empowered Howard.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
He empowered Howard.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot of this is to get back to the original point, which is that in a lot of ways, the mix or who you choose to mix your song has a huge impact on your aesthetic and your brand. And this mm-hmm. is something that Brock and I talk about a lot. He, you know, one of his stories is one of his very first bands. They actually would have been like probably really big, but they rushed the record. They rushed the mix. They wanted to save money, all this stuff. And he and the other guitar player were trying to talk them out of doing this. Like, let's pay the extra few thousand dollars, like get a really good mix done. Don't push this, you know, debut of the album. And yeah, I think it changed the course of that band for a really long time. Yeah. And it's got a huge impact that a lot of people might not realize.
Also, Jason, did you guys self-produce or did you work with a producer?
So the guy who engineered the record kind of produced it with us. You know, we do so much writing in the studio and mm-hmm. and we have the ability to at least like do pre-pro a little bit that yeah. we get pretty far. But then when we get in to actually do the tracking, you know, he helps us put that last 10% on it,
yeah.
you know, iron out the like, hey, I don't think those two notes are exactly right. And you right. know, little stuff.
Oh, that's Corey.
No, but I think that producers can have that 10%. They can have 2%. They can have 90%. But I think that it depends on what the artist needs. And also, you know, it depends on probably how much, I'm sure further into an artist's career as well, once you develop a sound and you know, artists that have been doing it forever are basically walking into a studio like it's just another Saturday and they know what's going on. But it can really make a big difference. And to your point, Siobhan, like what Brock was saying, sometimes cheaping out, if you're a new artist and you're going to record for the first time or record like your real first record that you're going to try to promote, I think a lot of new artists think they know more than they do about how to make their music translate. And so a producer can act as that little filter that says like, all right, like you guys have some great songs, but people are going to turn it off before the first verse comes in. Cause you guys are doing this.
You're 100% right.
Technology has enabled people to think that they know more about things than they do because now
people have always thought they knew more.
But you don't have to go and spend $1,000 to be in a studio anymore to have good quality stuff. But that doesn't make you a good songwriter or have good songs. You're just capable of recording yourself well. And like, that's the thing is like, I've met so many bands that are like, they know how to do things, but they're lacking the thing that makes a band, like the music or this or that. And people are so concerned with, you know, oh man, I got these pre's or I got this mic or I got this room. And they don't remember that the song like has to matter. No, dude, my fucking studio's treated like bullshit. This room sounds like crap. The standing ways.
Siobhan, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, but you're totally right. And that's what changed with Brock and his second band, Live My Last, is that they decided to work with a producer. And that's exactly what it was. They had like what they thought were some great songs and went in and the producer was like, all right, this is like pretty good, but we're basically going to start over. Yeah. And he took like the bare bones of what he saw was the best stuff and helped them really write a song that made them like, you know, get pretty big pretty quickly. So it's
well,
it's
Corey
totally
does it better than that, though. You know, I know he does. He makes you do it by yourself and then goes, is that really what you want to do?
I don't make you do
it. I could fix it. I mean, I could fix it. I mean, I got a lot. I could fix it. And then it's just like, okay, and I'll send it again. And then he'll be like, well, I auto-tuned one part and I ducked this other part. Wait, what are you saying? Oh, it's just not, I thought it was good. And then I'll do it again. And he'll just be like, it's in there.
I mean, I think, you know, Siobhan, to your point, which I think is so, so important. Young artists have to understand how little amount of time they actually have with the public. You know, me as somebody who's a grown man who has friends in the music industry who are grown men and who I believe legitimately respect me. One of my closest friends, huge manager in the scene, hires me to do stuff to help him out all the time, talks about how much he respects me. He's had the recordings of this EP for a year and a half. And when I put out the video, he was like, well, this really sounds good. Why didn't you send me the stuff? And I'm like, you've had it for a year and a half, bro. And he's like, oh, yeah. And I talk to him every day almost. He still has not listened to the rest of it. Right? Like, and this is a person who, like, yeah. You're one of my best friends, Jason. And I'm like, thanks, man.
Poopsenders.com.
like, listen to my record. But that's the reality. And it's not because he doesn't respect me. It's because he's busy and he doesn't have necessarily time to do that. I mean, other people that I know who I really respect, I sent them the first mix.
Is he on Cameo? Because we can hire him as a marketing expense to listen to your song.
And he's then not we on Cameo.
We'll tell him you're on Cameo. We'll throw him a few bucks.
I'm pretty sure he still has a flip phone. He's a little up there.
But so that means PayPal's out.
Yeah. But, you know, then I send them the new mixes and I get responses like, oh, man, these new songs are great, man. I really like this stuff better than the old stuff. And I'm like, it's the same song.
It's the same song. Right? Yeah.
Like, and it, even people that you respect and that you know, if they hear something that they don't like that doesn't resonate with them, it's gone. It's out. And I believe that the people I sent it to listened to it. This guy specifically, I know he listened to it, but it didn't resonate because it wasn't good. It wasn't where it needed to be yet. And you just have to realize that you're making a record. This may be that song that you're working on right at that moment, maybe the only thing that multiple people in the world ever hear you do.
To make it worse, people have the ability now to quickly toggle through everything. You know, it's like 2 seconds of something. And if you don't like the sound of it or whatever, even if you're not even if you're not a musician and you don't know why you don't like it, you know, you're just like, all right, on to the next.
Yeah. That's the other problem.
Totally right.
I say that all the time. I think the average person doesn't know the difference between a bad mix and a bad band. They have no clue.
The whole point of a producer is to get what's in the artist's head to actually come out instead of them trying to do it, because then it'll just be a mess.
And that's why it's also important to make sure you pick the right producer.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Meet with the producer beforehand. Have a conversation. Make sure you guys are on the same page. Because you also have the problem sometimes of a person getting in the studio and having their own opinion about something and about what your music is. I'm also not probably the best person for this, but I have never made a record where I haven't gotten in at least one argument with the person who's making the record with me, because I'm like, no, this is the vision.
If I ever produce you, I would just use Jason Lechberg tactics. I'd just be like, listen, you hired me, but you do whatever you want. Like, I've told you that it's wrong, but that's fine. Like, I've literally expressed it in every way politely.
Valid tactic, though.
I'm only a classical pianist that worked with Marty Friedman, and you're only a singer that knows nothing. But listen, stick to the marketing thing. But you're right.
Or we can talk about Ben's way of producing, which is like, oh, here's Siobhan. Why don't you just do whatever you want with this? Just decide, orchestrate it. I'm out. And then after 40 hours of work, like, oh, no, that's not. It has to be. You have to do it this way. I'm like, why couldn't you tell me this from the beginning?
Do you not understand?
Is Rick Rubin?
don't even put that idea in his
Rick
head.
Rubin never even comes back. He never comes back. He just gets pizza and he's gone. And then he yells at someone on the phone. Is there someone still yelling at someone? He's like, yeah, cool.
But you gotta
Metallica.
If you watch Shangri-La, that docuseries he put out, he has spent years cultivating when the right time to be in the room is, and now he knows when the right
time
to be
in
the room
is. Listen, my buddy Dave, who produced my first record, was his engineer at Sound City Studios. Okay, and I know all about it. He's like, dude, I worked on the Sabbath record, the Lady Gaga record, and like Gaga called him Squirrel. He was known as Cooter because he was from South of the Mesa Dixon line. And he would also have gotten a Dodge probably tattooed on him, except he was too covered in oil to even waste his time in a tattoo parlor. But now he was working for fucking Rick Rubin. You know what he said? I did everything in that studio. He wasn't there for fucking shit. And my name's barely in the liner notes of things. And I'm not saying that Rick Rubin is not a good producer, but I don't think his tactic of not being there is good production. That's just smart economics.
Well, there's different kinds of some life. Producers find the right people to make shit happen. And some producers are more hands on. It's just there's different styles. You know, producer is such a meaningless term.
The Dow of Rubin.
Producers
smoke a dab while someone else is left to her own devices using Pro Tools. But, you know, whatever.
I don't mean to be the sauerkraut in the Rubin.
I hate sauerkraut.
Don't order the Rubin. The Rick Rubin.
I don't order Rubens. I don't like sauerkraut or rye bread.
I just remember a certain Corey Taylor telling me, like, dude, that guy, nah. And I was like, really? But then again, I feel like when I met Corey, he's nice, though. He's nice.
What?
No, I'm just saying Rick Rubin. I just feel like he was one of those guys. Like, he made Slayer and Run DMC, and he did so much cool stuff. And then he was just like, I could just order a pizza in Maui and do my own thing, and then I'll walk into the room.
You know,
when it's
really,
time for me to flex my muscle.
I really appreciate the spiritual. I don't even like the word spiritual, but I appreciate the mental way that he approaches music. I appreciate the way he thinks about art, and I appreciate the way he talks about art, and that he encourages other artists to think about themselves and about art. And I think that's valuable. What he does in the studio, I don't know. I probably will never know. I don't think he and I would get along in the studio. Just operate on different wavelengths.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think the beginning of this conversation was, you know, that you've put a lot into these recordings, regardless. And everyone should definitely check out Nefariant and Life
Thank
on
you.
Fire. And
well, the whole EP is out now.
Okay.
So we dropped the whole EP at the same time.
Wait,
so
has it been out for a year and we just didn't pay attention? Did you already send this to me?
This is, yes.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I listened to everything. It's actually awesome.
First, we had it after our first recording. But
in fact,
for the people listening,
I thought it was awesome. I got to say hats off because I've heard your old band, and your old band was good. And I was like, all right. But like, again, it kind of like the elitist, like, it didn't move me. But then I listened to this new stuff, and I'm with Corey. Like, this, it sound, first off, different. So like, that's good, just especially as a producer, like, you know, where a lot of people are like, I don't like it because it's different. Like, that's first off the reason why I immediately like something is because it's different. But secondly, the dichotomy of your vocals is really fucking intense. And again, like, you know, the layers of intense melodicism, but then again, intense aggressivity is a new approach to it. And I really liked it. And Ulrich, and knowing that Ulrich Wilde did what he did, and then having spoken to him, it makes so much sense that your band has got that sound, and that you guys were so smart to have him involved, because he really nailed it, because listening to it with headphones on was really wonderful. Because I mean, you know, as a guy that has to listen to mixes all the time, when a mix sounds good, it's always like, oh, I don't have to lie.
What, yeah. I was getting at, you mentioned a treatment for another video. Are you guys doing more like single pushes like that, or?
I mean, we'd love to. You know, our plan is three EPs over the next couple of years, and then a physical product that wraps all of them up at the end. So three digital EPs. And look, we love the songs on this EP. We're already almost done writing the second EP.
Nice.
It really comes down to money. You know, we're self-funding this. You know, it's just us, and I'm very fortunate to have four other dudes in the band who all work very hard and are as dedicated as I am. But Ulrich's not cheap. You know, Paul Logos, who mastered it, is not cheap. Licensing the art from Eric Lacombe, who's a
dude, you can send
artist.
Your songs for $20 and they'll master it for you right on the internet with a program live. Like, you just put it up and it's like, in the time it takes to say calculating, you get it back and your song's mastered. Why would you even waste your money?
You know, sometimes I do stupid things like get my own face tattooed on my arm. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I just do dumb shit. So,
as we've established, you should pay the experts.
And actually, Jason, I was waiting for you to take the layup, like Lost Symphony Chapter 3. Should probably be dropping very close to when this is going to be here. And actually, how well our marketing campaign goes will determine how much we, you know, obsess and also bother Jason's life. So if you guys would like to help Jason have a better quality of life, as well as contribute to the patronage of what we really are doing here on the show, which is pretending that we aren't really a band putting out like a tip jar on the internet, go to LostSymphony.com, buy Chapter 3. It's for our fallen friend and brother that really brought Siobhan, me and Corey, and my brother, who's a big part of this together. We got Marty Friedman to come out to the dance. We got David Ellison to come out to the dance. We got Alex Skolnick come out to the dance. Jimmy Bell, the best lefty, I argue, on the fucking planet. You got Matt LaPierre, who's a beast. Kelly, who literally is burning up Jackson because this guy wasn't even endorsed before. And now, like, just people watching him against Jeff Loomis, who's also on the album. You can't ignore the fact that he's a freaking psychopath as far as guitar is concerned, and add to it the fact that you sir know one Mr. Alex Skolnick, who, by the way, at some point, like, if people haven't seen the episode, like the fact that you got him at your wedding is just fucking phenomenal. But I, because of that camaraderie that you had with him, we also got Skolnick and we got Nuno Betancourt on the same song. So if you guys don't even care about this episode, but you guys like guitar, or you loved All That Remains, Ollie Herbert, or you, you just like metal or classical music, but you want something different, LostSymphony.com.
That was a great introduction.
I couldn't say it better.
Except the show's like over, so it's like bye.
That's the time
this is
you
your
genuinely
epic
thrive.
Summary. Yeah.
As we wrap up the show is when you usually take off.
Here's the good news. The magic of editing. Yeah.
Don't you know that, haven't you watched a show at all, Jason? See, you just got annoyed. Corey doesn't like editing things, and he's certainly not going to edit it Quentin Tarantino style, where he's like, oh, well, maybe it would have been better if Benny only interjected 20 minutes in at this time. He doesn't have fucking time for that shit. The amount of time it takes to edit me to look even remotely affable is just, there is, it's not quantifiable.
Yeah, I just use a machete. It's just kind of, that section's, all right, get it out of there. No,
machete.
You use Danny Trejo?
Yes.
That's fucking yes, awesome. Absolutely. You like, you show them, oh,
that's,
Benny
that's what's
Goodman.
Required.
Yeah. Anyways. So anyways, yes, Lost Symphony Chapter 3 is incredible. And added to chapter one and chapter two, it is a very impressive body of work. And I, you know, I've said it before, but I'm happy to say it again. You know, I mean, I'm excited to work with all of you because of the quality of the music. I mean, the stuff you guys are putting out is
certainly not our personalities. And on that note, Jason, thank you for coming back
thank
for another
you, Jason.
Couple hours.
Yeah,
of this
was
bullshit.
Amazing. All the stuff we covered. It's yeah, it was nice to veer off in a bunch of different directions on these episodes. Like,
I'm only here for the mortgage payment, man.
Fair enough.
Check out Nefariant. We'll have links below this episode. Wherever you're watching or listening, there'll be a link there. Check out Lechbert Enterprises. And Jason, what else? You know, anything else you want to tell our 12,
where are your live shows
14
again?
Listeners?
June 12th and August 21st. Arrogant Swine is the name of the location in Brooklyn. But your listeners should absolutely check out Lost Symphony. Got a lot more coming for them. More 2020 episodes, more Neurotic Guitarist episodes coming. A lot of good stuff. So I'm that's what people should check out, because we'll get to Nefariant. That'll happen. It'll be all right.
Well, in the meantime, 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe. Go listen to Jason's other episodes, all of our other guests.
YouTube.com/TheNeuroticGuitarist.
Ben shamelessly plugging everything.
SiobhanCronin.com. If it's not taken, you should buy it and then ransom it back.
Oh, I have it already.
You do?
Yeah.
Are you sure? Does Anne-Marie Cronin have all the passwords?
No. Actually, I do. I bought it a long time ago. I have a website. It's just old and outdated. Because I unfortunately don't have time to maintain my own stuff. So busy doing everyone else.
You might
else.
Know some people who can help out with that.
That's true. I'll hit you up.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 65, featuring David Abbruzzese. Check it out.
I've always been bothered that so many, like the Vitalogy record, the cassette that I have of the rough mixes eclipses the final record and the mastering. You know, it's like, it's so rich and so dynamic. And then in the mastering, it just got squashed too much, in my opinion.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Frates from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.